me in. Shiba shiba. I want to be closer to you. Shiba shiba. Open up your soul. Shiba shiba. Let me find that part of you. The part that nobody ever knew.
Let me touch your. Hello and welcome to Let Me Touch Your Mind, the show where we try to get you to be something, do something, experience something, enjoy something. And every year, I enjoy the Silent Film Festival. Sadly, this year, I won't be able to enjoy it because I'm chasing the eclipse even as this interview is being aired. But that doesn't mean that I have to stop you from enjoying the Silent Film Festival. So here to talk about it, America's favorite silent film maven, Anita Monga. How are you?
Hi, Marilyn. I didn't know you were going to the eclipse.
Yeah, we're going to be traveling because it's going to be like 4.5 minutes. It's a ridiculously long amount of time. So I'm very excited about that. But I'm sad that I'm going to miss the Silent Film Festival. So let's not talk about the eclipse because that makes us all, you know, we have all kinds of mixed feelings about it. Let's talk about the Silent Film Festival. But before we do, I don't think I've ever asked you when or how did you get into curating films.
Oh, you mean way back in the before?
Yeah, like it, because you know, when you're planning a career in your life, you know, you're planning like doctor, lawyer, ballerina, fire, you know what I mean? That's not one of the things that you think of right away.
Well, I didn't think of it either. I just fell into it. Essentially, I was really a good friend of mine, Kurt McDowell, and I worked together at a ceramics factory. Mm-hmm. And his boyfriend was one of the founders of the Roxy Cinema.
Oh.
And so we'd go home after the ceramics factory and watch 16 millimeter films at his house, but also then we'd just trip around the corner to the Roxy.
Mm-hmm.
And so we decided to put on our own show. And so we talked to Robert Evans, who he was in a relationship with, and Peter Moore, who would go on to be my future husband,
mm-hmm.
about letting us do a show. And they said, okay. And essentially that's how it happened. We were able to do the midnight show at the Roxy for, I don't know, a month. Mm-hmm. And we did all the PR, we put it on the calendar, did everything, curated it. And then I just kind of loved it. I love the idea of sharing movies with people.
That's amazing. And it sounds like you did it when you were still like, what do they call it? Young, dumb, and broke, so that you don't know how difficult something's going to be, and which means that you actually end up doing it.
Yeah, it was fun. Now the idea of going to a established theater and saying, hey, let us put on a show is just, you can't imagine that. Also in San Francisco, it was really cheap to live. And, you know, I think I was paying $70 a month rent to live with five other people, but we lived in a big Victorian, you know, railroad flat.
Uh-huh.
So it was, I think having low rents really increases the creativity of a city.
Sure. So, yeah, because artists are always broke. So the only way you can get them is if there's a place to live that's affordable.
Exactly.
So, okay. So fast forward, when do you think I'm going to put on a silent film festival?
Well, I didn't think of that, you know, so I went from the Roxy to the York Theater, which no longer exists. It's on 24th Street and now is the Brava, the Brava Theater.
Mm-hmm.
But that once was a movie theater. And then I was brought in to do the Castro when Mel Novikoff, who owned the Surf chain of theaters, was dying. And so it was, the theaters were being sold. And they brought me in to program the last of the Castro calendars, which just the new owners decided they really liked what we were doing and said, keeper.
Very nice, very
so
nice.
So then, you know, at the Castro, the Castro, you know, I had done silent films at the York Theater, but it always always needed to have a track on the, you know, a sound track, because there was no way to make music at the York.
But it was
at
so
the Castro,
small.
There was the Mighty Wurlitzer. The York wasn't small at all. There was just no instruments.
Oh,
there.
okay.
So, but the Castro had the Mighty Wurlitzer, which at the time was a preeminent theater organ in the country. And so I would do regular, I do these kind of vertical series a lot. So it would be like, you know, Monday silence, Tuesday noir, Wednesday blah blah.
I remember those print the
exactly.
Yeah.
Right. So the so it was a so I did a regular number of silence at the Castro, and then Melissa Chittick and Steve Sammons had the idea to do a silent film festival, and they really, every time we do a silent film at the Castro, they would come and question the line about if there was going to be a silent film festival, would you come? And of course, everybody said yes. So when they finally launched the festival, it was an instant success. And so, but I did not come to the silent film festival until 2009.
Okay. Oh, okay. Because it seems like you've been doing it forever.
It does, doesn't it?
Does that mean that I interviewed you when you first started at this?
Oh, yeah.
Wow. Yeah. I had no idea. I thought you were just like, you had been doing it for years and years and years.
Yeah, I left the Castro in 2004. And then I was working at for some festivals, film festivals, the Seattle Film Festival and the Palm Springs Film Festival, and did various other little festivals. But yeah. But by 2009, Melissa and Steve had both left, and Stacy Wisnia, our executive director,
who's
took
awesome,
over being the executive director of the Silent Film Festival. And when Steve left the programming, she asked me to come along. So, yes, that's how it happened.
And the rest is history. And then it seems like every year, the Silent Film Festival, you manage to dig up these films that you've either, they were quote unquote lost, meaning that they were just hanging out in Bolivia or, you know, New Zealand or someplace like that. Does that still happen?
You know what just happened for us now? And this was like far into our planning for this festival. Silent Film Festival has a preservation arm, and the preservation arm does restorations of film. And we were restoring a Clara Bow title called Dancing Mothers. And so that was always going to be on the schedule for the 2024 festival. But just a couple months ago, a collector in Omaha went to like a, you know, a driving, a parking lot sale, and found a collection of film cans, and he was looking for an animated short, but the seller wouldn't allow him to just get the one he wanted. It was just like, you have to take them all. If you're gonna buy this, you have to take them all. And he did. This guy's name is Gary Huggins. And he was looking through the films. He realized that one of the films was another Clara Bow short called The Pill Pounder. And it's hilarious. It's really, really beautifully hilarious. It's Clairvaux had a very small part. She was only 17 years old. It was
Okay.
like one of her first roles. And it stars a Irish comedian named Charlie Murray is the big part of this. But it was also directed by Gregory LaCava, who did My Man Godfrey. So its provenance is pretty great. But yeah, it's we had no choice but to restore that film. So that's going to be in the festival also.
I love that. And I
And
also
again, nobody knew that, you know, it was rumored that Clairvaux had a part in that film, but nobody really knew for sure till they unspooled the reel.
Wow. And it wasn't degrading or anything, because you talk
You
about
know,
that vinegar thing.
It required restoration, but it was in pretty good shape.
Wow.
The thing that happened to it was that there obviously had been intertitles, you know, silent film always, because nobody speaks. So
Sure.
there's intertitles in between to tell what's going on. Somebody had cut the intertitles out of this film, probably because they intended to do a hilarious voiceover at some point. But the film, they haven't, you know, still looking for the lost intertitles, but the film does not need them. It's like so beautifully hilarious that you do not need anybody to explain to you what's going on.
Sure. What I love about that story is he went to like a parking lot sale. And I've done those things where it's like, nope, you got to take them all, because it's like you just want it gone. And it's
Right.
like, if you want one, you got to take them all.
Right. Right. So Gary is a filmmaker himself. So he, with this one find, he's been interviewed by people around the world about this lost film. And also David Sten, the collector, like essentially bought the film for us to restore. And
Wow.
it got Gary enough funds so that he could go to Japan to a film showing of his own. So
That's
it's a good
great.
story. Yeah.
So like how many films were in this lot of things that he had to take?
I am not certain of that, but it took him several weeks to get to the one that was
Oh, okay. So quite a few. Quite a few. Got it. Got it. Got it. All right. So what's the name of that title again?
It's called The Pill Pounder.
The Pill Pounder. That's right. That's right.
And
Which
it's
has a
going to
different
be,
meaning today.
well, it takes place in a drugstore. So,
Sure.
So.
All right. So with that in mind, is there a theme this year, or is it just fabulous, fabulous silent films?
That's our theme, fabulous silent films. We don't do themes really, and sometimes there's kind of like accidental themes that come through. Like one year we realized that we had like four films where babies were thrown off cliffs and out of windows and stuff. But we don't try for themes. What we try to do is balance the program. So, you know, comedy, drama, you know, we try to balance like tone and also try to get diverse countries involved. This year again we're trying to do like a Ukrainian title every year, and this year we're doing a Ukrainian comedy called The Opportunist. That's really beautifully funny. You know, we have a couple films from Sweden, including one by the Danish director Benjamin Christensen, Haxen, which is about
Oh,
witchcraft.
yeah.
Yes. And the Matthew Bai Ensemble is going to do their amazing accompaniment to Haxen. We also doing The Phantom Carriage, which is like one of the masterpieces of all cinema, not just the silent cinema. It inspired people from, Ingmar Bergman and Stanley Kubrick. And
And what's that one again?
it's called The Phantom Carriage.
And what makes it a masterpiece? Because I've heard
So,
about Napoleon and the Battleship Potemkin, but I don't think I've heard this one.
well, The Phantom Carriage is, some people call it the cinema's first ghost story.
Ooh,
You
well,
know,
now
it
I'm sad
can't.
I'm missing it.
Yeah, I know. I'm sad you're missing it too. It's just a ghost story is giving it short shrift because
Okay.
it's very deep and very knowing about the human condition. Victor Sjostrom, who also directed The Wind, and I'm trying to think of titles that people will know. But Sjostrom also, as an actor, he's an actor in The Phantom Carriage, but also showed up in Ingmar Bergman's Wild Strawberries,
Okay.
which is also a masterpiece. So, yeah, it's beautiful. I'm trying to think of other things. Poker Faces is a film we're showing is a it's a this wild comedy with Edward Everett Horton and Walk on the Plant.
For people who recognize the name but they're not sure, whenever you watched Fractured Fairy Tales, his was the name that you or his was the voice that
Exactly.
you would hear.
Exactly. So it's so interesting to see him in a silent film because his voice is so distinctive. And he's a great actor, on top of being that beautiful voice that shows up not only in Fractured Fairy Tales, but he was in Fred Astaire movies, always that, very supercilious guy. Along with comedies, we're also doing something by Charlie Chaplin's. With Charlie Chaplin's brother, Sid Chaplin. This film is called Oh, What a Nurse.
Okay.
And Sid Chaplin made a kind of minor celebrity of himself for he dressed in, he was like a female impersonator. So
Okay.
often in films, he's dressed as a woman, he's dressed as the nurse. We're doing also The Kid Brother, the Harold Lloyd film, and Sherlock Jr. I guess we're doing a lot of comedies. But to balance it out, we want to get a little Weimar on everybody with The Devious Path and The Street. So two beautiful, not comedies, but people know about the Weimar cinema. Those are two stellar examples of Weimar.
And this year you're doing the Silent Film Festival in a different venue.
We are indeed, the Castor is closed right now. And so, we have very particular needs at the
Sure.
Silent Film Festival. It has to be big enough for us. Because we have live musical accompaniment. And so we have to have as many seats as possible, or our ticket prices would be sky high.
Sure.
Because putting music and movies together is a very expensive proposition. So it requires, and also we like to have a lot of people in the room together. So
So where is it this year?
it's at the Palace of Fine Arts Theater, which is in the Palace of Fine Arts complex. And the Palace of Fine Arts is one of San Francisco's most beloved historical sites. It was built for the 1915 World's Fair, and it was built not to be permanent, but it was so beloved at the time that, in fact, years later, they restored it. So it got built again. So you know, it's we on our website, we have a whole you know, how to get around. And so we list all of the ways that people can get to the palace. And also there's a big parking lot, so there's at least that. But yeah, it's a schlep for people who live on the east side of town or
Okay.
in the East Bay,
Sure.
like me.
Well, it starts on the 10th. How long does it run?
It starts on the 10th and goes to the 14th. And I forgot to talk about the several like big epics we're doing we're on opening night.
Which
Black
are?
Pirate. The Black Pirate, which is the Douglas Fairbanks film, and it was just restored by MoMA with the Film Foundation in beautiful, beautiful two color Technicolor. It's
Oh.
amazing. So it's like looking like an old master's painting now.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
And the other
so we're
one?
doing the Seahawk from UCLA. Just did a scan, and our own restoration of the Red Mark, which takes place on a penal colony island. Yeah, it's a really good festival. I'm sorry you have to miss it.
I'm sorry too. I'm gonna have to get the book that you guys always put out so that I can make sure to try and see. And that before I ask, because we're almost out of time, but I do want to know, once you've restored them and you've showed them, then what happens to them? Do they go out on DVD? Do they go to like a place like Canopy, or like how do people get to see them once they're restored?
We well, first of all of our restorations go to 35, and those 35 millimeter prints go to the Library of Congress, where
Okay.
they are available for people, film festivals and film exhibitors. But we also work with a couple distributors, so, and we also put stuff out on VCP, which is the new modern way people see film. All of the film festivals do DCP. I think it's the acronyms for digital cinema package.
Okay.
But anyway, all films you see in the theater are essentially DCP, except
Okay.
for if somebody makes a big deal about it, like Christopher Nolan with 35 or 70 millimeter. So in that way, Flickr Alley is one of the distributors we work with. Milestone is one of the distributors we work with. So people can look for our DVDs if the
Okay.
distributor
All
submits.
right. And then for people who want to go to the festival this year, where do they get tickets? What's the website? How do they find out the programming?
You can find all of that out at silentfilm.org. You can find out the complete schedule. You can buy tickets there, everything. You know, buy tickets at the door, but you know what? It's always best to do it in advance. And
Sure.
also, we have our full program pass available on our tickets on our website, silentfilm.org.
Excellent. Well, Anita Manga, as you know, it's always a pleasure to talk to you. And I'm going to get a hold of that silent film book and make it an effort to see all the ones that you're showing this year.
Have a good eclipse, Marilyn.
Thank you. And thank you for being on the show. All right, people of Earth, this is your opportunity to check out the Silent Film Festival, which is always pleasurable and enjoyable. And they always have live music, and it's fabulous.
Disguises, no one knows. It's the face lies the snake and the sun in my disgrace. Boiling heat, summer stench, 'neath the black the sky looks dead. Call my name through the crane and I'll hear you scream again. Black hole sun, won't you come and wash away the rain? Black hole sun, won't you come? Won't you come, won't you come? Stuttering, cold and damp, steal the warm with tired friend. Times are gone for honest men, and sometimes far too long for slaves. In my shoes, walking slim, in my soul I pray to keep. Heaven send hell away. No one sings like you anymore. Black hole sun, won't you come? Ba 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 ba, wash away the rain. Black hole sun, won't you come? Won't you come? Ooh, won't you cold sign? Won't you come and wash away the rain? Black cold sign, won't you come? Won't you come? Black cold sign, won't you come and wash away?
My next guest is a San Francisco treat. He is an award-winning playwright, actor, and talk show host, and he has the longest-running solo show in San Francisco history. For those of you who don't know him, he's fabulous. His name is Brian Copeland. Welcome.
Hey, thank you for having me. San Francisco Street, I feel like Rice-A-Roni. Thank you.
You are Rice-A-Roni. Anybody? Yeah, so you've been around a long time. So before we get into why you're here, when did you start either acting or writing? Or in which came first?
Gosh, it was actually the first time I started writing, actually, I was 12 years old. Mm-hmm. I had a column in the San Leandro paper, a little San Leandro Weekly. They gave me a little column once a week. I had 200 words.
At 12?
At the age of 12.
Wow.
I did that from 12 to 15. I started show business when I was 18, a couple of weeks after I graduated from high school from Moreau Catholic in Hayward. And I started at the original Tommy T's in San Leandro, and it just kind of went from there, you know, went from there.
And was the acting thing something your parents saw coming a mile away, or did you just blindside them?
Acting, I started in school plays, in elementary school. I fell in love with the theater, and I fell in love with drama. Mm-hmm. And I did it throughout high school, and I did it in college as well. So just something I really sort of fell into. I never thought I would do it professionally. It was mm-hmm. something that I loved, you know. And then when I started doing stand-up, you know, there are elements of theater. You know, I found ways to incorporate elements of theater in my stand-up.
So you did stand-up comedy?
Oh yeah, that's my main gig for years. Before I started doing one-man shows, I was a stand-up comic for 20 years. I opened for Ray Charles and Aretha Franklin, Ron Warwick and Smokey Robinson and Ringo Starr and the list goes on and on. I've opened for folks, you know, for years. I played Constitution Hall. I played the Universal Amphitheater with Gladys mm-hmm. Knight and Smokey Robinson. So I was all over the place. And then I wrote this one-man show back in 2003 that called Not a Genuine Black Man. And where it came from was I was a talk show host for KGO Radio when KGO was doing talk uh-huh. back in the day. And I got an anonymous letter from somebody who said, as an African-American, I'm disgusted every time I hear your voice because you are not a genuine black man. So I thought about, okay, why would somebody say that to me? And I've had people say that to me before. Oh, you're not really white. Oh, you're an Oreo. Oh, you're white on the inside, that kind of thing. And I thought, wait, it's because from the age of 8, when my family moved to San Leandro, which was mm-hmm. 99% white, mm-hmm. I spent my formative years as the only black face in the room. And when you are a child and you're growing up, you assimilate, you learn to assimilate. You speak yes. like your friends. You're in the mm-hmm. You have the same your friends have. So I started to write this play, and I walked my kids to school in the morning. And then I set up this little cafe called Sabino's in San Leandro with marble composition notebooks and number 2 natural wood pencils. And I wrote down every story I could think of about what it was like to be different, about what it was like to be the only one. Because mm-hmm. at some point, no matter who you are, you're going to be in a situation where you're the only one, the only man, the only woman, the only black, the only white, the only Christian, right. whatever. And how do you navigate those waters when you're the only one? So when I was at about maybe 10 of these notebooks filled with stories, you know, some were funny, some were sad, some were things that I had suppressed because they were so incredibly painful, I had blocked them out of my mind. Mm-hmm. And I wrote these stories down with the mindset that this is a diary, nobody's ever going to see this. So that way I could be honest. Mm-hmm. So when I had about 10 of these things, I thought, okay, I got enough raw material. Let me see if I can figure out what was going on in San Leandro at the time we moved there in 72, just to give the story some, you know, a background, mm-hmm. you know, to set the scene. So I went to the library and the head librarian, I told her I was writing a play about what it was like when there weren't to live here and there weren't many black people here. And she gave me a term paper that was written in 1967 by a San Leandro resident who was attending what was then Cal State Hayward, is now Cal State East Bay. Mm-hmm. And it was called How San Leandro's 10 Homeowners Associations Keep the City an All-White Ghetto. And I went, what? And I looked at this paper, it's about 10 pages. And that was ground zero for me in terms of this play. He had interviewed people who told stories about the redlining and the housing discrimination and how a police officer sat at the Oakland San Leandro border and it was his job to follow any black pedestrian, motorist, or cyclist wow. who crossed into the city limits and to follow even little kids on bikes and to follow them until either he found a pretext to stop them or they were so intimidated they made a U-turn and went back to Oakland.
Wow.
I found out that the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights had conducted hearings in 1967 to find out why it was that once you crossed over into this, if you were black, once you crossed over into the city limits, you could not get a mortgage if you were African American. The major banks, Wells Fargo, Bank of America, they would not give you a mortgage. The realtors would not show you a home. Those kinds of things. So wow. I didn't know that it was at the time, it was an organized plot You know, Oakland, at the time, Oakland's black population was swelling throughout the 60s, and you had a white flight. And people moved to places like San Leandro, where they could keep you, where they could keep black people out. And it was coordinated conspiracy between the realtors, the homeowners association, the city council, and it was all enforced by the San Leandro Police Department. So I thought, wow, okay, the entire focus of this play now has changed. It's not just about my evolution, but it's about the evolution of a city. So I wrote this play, and it opened in April of 2004 at the Marsh in San Francisco. It was just, you know, it was around for 6 weeks. It was kind of a lark. And I thought, well, you know, this is, you know, something that I'll, you know, I've done. I got out of my system. I was booked at the Improv in San Jose at the end of the run. I was supposed to just go back to stand up. And the first night we had like 10 people. The second night we had like 40 people. And by the third night it was sold out. And then reviews came out, and the reviews were like stellar. And so it was packed every night. And so the show ended up running at the Marsh. The first run was 2 years. Then it went off Broadway. Then it went to Los Angeles, and then we came back to San Francisco. And I was friends with Carl, with the legendary Carl Reiner. It was Carl who put me on the right to write this thing. You know, Carl told me to find the piece of ground that I alone stood on and write from there. And that was what got me thinking.
That's amazing advice. Go on.
Yeah. So I told Carl, okay, I took your advice. I wrote this play. People seemed to like it. He goes, well, I'd like to see it. Do you have a recording of it? And I thought, well, yeah, we just shot a video the night before. And the idea was the video was just something that we shot that I was going to, you know, have for later on when I had grandkids to go, it was something I did when I was younger. And so I sent it to him, and he said, this is amazing. This is great. Robbie's got to see this. Said, Robbie? Who the heck's Robbie? And he's talking about Rob Reiner, the director. So we sent it to Rob at Castle Rock Entertainment. And next thing I know, I'm headed to Beverly Hills to have a meeting about how to develop it for television. So Rob and I tried to develop it for TV. We had it set up at HBO. And then management at HBO changed, and so the project died.
Sure.
And so about 2 years ago, he got another TV development deal at Warner Brothers, and he said, let's try this again. So we have got scripts, and we wrote a script together, and we're set to go. We're going to start taking it around. In September, in the fall, we'll start taking it around.
That is an amazing story arc. It had everything. I love it, just from beginning to end. So, well, let me ask you about, so since they were so dead set against black folk moving to San Leandro, how'd y'all end up there? Did you ever ask your parents how you ended up being a fly in milk?
Well, now when you talk about my parents, one of the reasons that we left, that we ended up there, we left Hayward, which is where we've been living, was because my father was violently abusive. He abused my mother, he abused us kids, and at one point he strangled me to the point of being unconscious. And I talk about that in the play. And my mother said, we're going to get away from him. So it was my mother, my grandmother, and my little sisters who moved into this apartment complex in San Leandro. And my mother was what black folks call siddity. You know, she was born in Birmingham, but used to tell people she was from Providence, Rhode Island.
Okay. because she wanted to be high toned.
Sounded whiter. You know, she felt like you had to assimilate in order to survive in white society, and white society controls the world, controls this country. So the way we got into that complex, and I just found this out in the last couple of years, I did not know for years. She passed away when I was 14.
Okay.
I lost her when I was 14.
I'm sorry.
And the way she got in was she had a white girlfriend. Her best girlfriend and coworker was a white woman, pretty white woman. And she sent her to the apartment complex to get the application.
Okay.
And my mother filled it out, and her girlfriend turned it in. We had rented to people of color, the ownership. They were livid. And we went through an entire campaign of harassment and, you know, things that was blatant housing discrimination. And my mother ended up having to sue them over, you know, how it was we were treated, how they're trying to kick us out, and sue them for the right to stay there. I'm not going to tell you how it ended up, because that's a major storyline in the play.
Sure.
It's been a heck of a ride. You know, my 6 weeks is now, I had no idea that 20 years later I would be reviving this show. The original run ran the original run, you know, between all the places I bounced around with it, it was 7 years. It ran for 7 years the first time. And so now I've got, it's the 20th anniversary in April, and we're at the Marsh in San Francisco from April, I think, 4th, whatever the first Saturday is, until the first Saturday of May.
April 6th through May 4th.
Thank you. April 6th to May 4th. And on April 20th, it's a very, very special show because that is the actual 20th anniversary of the opening. It is the 1,000th performance of that show. Wow. And it's my birthday. So so that's the big show. That's the big show.
That's so amazing. So my question is, in doing this show, since you have had such a long run, do you think that anything has changed? Like, do you think people still would say that there are still a majority of people who say not a genuine Black man? Or do you think that people now are able to accept that there are all sorts of different permutations of how Black folks sound?
I think now is worse than it was 20 years ago.
Really?
In terms of how racists looked at, I think it's worse. Ever since Donald Trump gave people permission, Donald Trump gave people permission to say all of the racist nonsense that they had in their minds, but had the good sense not to let come out of their mouths, and they have no problem saying things. And I will tell you something interesting that I found out, and that is that what I got happens, the nonsense I heard about not being really Black, and I talk about racial identity in the play and what Blackness means. That's one of the themes. This goes on in every culture. I wrote a book that's based on the play. And the book, when we sent it out, there was a bidding war between publishers for it. And the reason is that one of the editors who wanted to buy it was an Asian woman who said, we were the only Asian family in our town in St. Louis, I think she said. Mm-hmm. And this is my story. And then another editor was a Latino editor who said, you know, we were the only Latinos, and I forget where I was, somewhere back east, in our, you know, town or in our community. And this is my story.
So it resonated with a bunch of people.
Resonated because it happens in every culture. Just like, just like I was called an Oreo, the Asians will be accused of being bananas.
Right.
You know, white on the outside. Latinos, they're coconuts, is what they'll call them. It's just nonsense that goes on in every culture, in every culture. So, but I think in terms of where we are today with race, I think we're way worse today than we were in 2004. So I've done a couple of performances of this show the last few weeks just to kind of get back into it, because I've done it a long time. Mm-hmm. And I did performances in Alameda at the Altarena Playhouse and at the Marin Shakespeare Company in San Rafael this past weekend. And the response was phenomenal. It's almost like it was a release for people. It's almost like, you know, I people told me I said what it was that they were thinking, and it's just people are receiving it. It was always well received, but they're receiving it in a different way because of the times and the climate in which we're living today.
Amazing, amazing. So, when you are doing it now, when you look at the material, do you approach it differently from how you did 20 years ago when, you know, because you have more perspective now than you would have then?
As an actor, not really.
Okay.
Not really. I do it the same way. There are some things that have changed in terms of a line here and there because there's a line that's dated or there is a line that is offensive. You know, and so that today that wasn't in 2004. So those kinds of things I've changed. There was a reference originally to Bill Cosby at the time when Bill Cosby was America's dad.
Yeah.
And it was a reference. I want to be a father like him. I was his opening act. Whenever he came to the Bay Area, I opened for him.
Wow. You know,
yeah. I opened for him right up until everything came out.
Sure.
I opened for him.
Sure. And now people are praying that they get to open for you, I'm imagining.
Well, that I don't know about.
Well, Brian Copeland, we mentioned the dates, which is April 6th through May 4th. So how often does it play? What time does it play? How do people get tickets?
I'm doing one show a week. Just Saturday nights, 5 o'clock. It's an early
show.
Okay.
Okay.
It's a 2-hour show, so it's 5 to 7-ish. It runs.
Where's the Marsh?
The Marsh is at 1062 Valencia Street in San Francisco in the Mission District. So grab your tickets. Grab your tickets. It's a limited run, and doing it this past couple of weeks, I have been reminded of how much I love this show and mm-hmm. how cathartic the show is, because it deals with a lot of, I mean, I'm pretty naked up there on that stage. I'm emotionally naked. I don't hold anything back. And I forgot how cathartic it was to do this show, because it deals a lot with the racism I dealt with as a kid. And then they end up with the same kind of racism for people in my own race as I got older.
Sure.
I deal with all of that stuff. I deal with depression and how I went to all suicidal bout of depression as a result of all that stuff building up. I talk about how it affected my children, mm-hmm. you know. So there's a lot, but I had forgotten how much I just really, you know, felt compelled to do that show once I started doing it regularly.
Well, you mentioned your children, so have you? I'm guessing your children have seen the show. Did your children see the show and see it as a window to their dad, or was it that, oh, this thing that my dad did, and so they kind of approach it like the way a teenager would approach whatever their parents are doing?
Well, let's see. When I first opened it, my kids were 8, 12, and 14. And mm-hmm. There's a large part of the show. It's two storylines. It's me as a child. Dealing with, you know, in 1972, as an 8-year-old, mm-hmm. dealing with what's going on. And then me as a 36-year-old, dealing with the ramifications of the things that I had pushed down in order to survive.
Mm-hmm.
And so when my kids saw it, you know, especially my youngest son, it was the same age that I was when this thing started, they looked at it as a window. They really looked at it as a window into me. When I was off Broadway, my daughter Carolyn, she was at the time, I think she was 15 at the time, and she came with me to New York,
mm-hmm.
and she saw it every single night. So she's the one who's seen it the most. She's seen something like 75 or 100 times. She's seen it. The others have seen it maybe a dozen times or so. And I had to kind of I sat them down before I opened the first time to tell them, okay, there's some things in the show. You know, and it was a while before I let the 8-year-old see it. I wanted him to be a little bit older, so the two older ones saw it.
Mm-hmm.
Two older saw it initially, like during they came opening night. As a matter of fact, they came. They were there.
Nice, nice. I love that. It's something that it's very rare for children to actually have a window into their parents' past that helps them decode what makes their parents tick and actually have more of a compassion in a different way than kids normally do with their parents. So I just think that's great. So
yeah.
So once again, for our listening audience, when and where for Not a Genuine Black Man and It's Not Lost on Me that your birthday's 420, go.
Actually, my birthday's 421. But we're
you're celebrating it on 420. Okay. All right.
It's actually... It's at the Mart, San Francisco, 1062 Valencia Street. Again, it's on Saturday nights at 5. Tickets are available now. Just go to themarsh.org, or you can go to briancopeland.com and go click the thing that the tab this is now playing, and it tells you all the places where I'm playing, and you can click a link to buy tickets. But between now and opening, then we were talking off the air. I'm headed to New Orleans on Easter. Rob Reiner has cast me in his newest movie, which is a sequel to This Is Spinal Tap. So he's bringing Spinal Tap back, and it's going to be an interesting experience for me as an actor, because it's all ad lib. You know, the script is all ad lib.
Wow.
The paragraph that describes the scene. Here's what the scene is. Here's how it begins. Here's how it ends. And here's what kind of needs to happen, you know, in between.
Uh-huh.
And then, go. That was like, yeah, just go. And so you start ad-libbing. You know, you have a conversation, and hopefully gold comes out of something. So it's going to be really interesting. I can't talk about the plot
Sure.
or what my role is, but I can tell you that if it comes off half as good as the 10-page synopsis I was sent, it's going to be a really funny movie. And lots of people are in it. Paul McCartney's in it. Elton John is in it. Ringo Starr, Garth Brooks, Trisha Yearwood. So he's got a lot of star cameos in it. He's got a lot of star cameos in it. Brad Drescher, who's the president of our union, SAG-AFTRA, and who was, of course, the nanny. She was in the first one, so she's in it. So it's gonna be fun. It's
So it's a
really,
bunch of
really
heavy hitters. So that shows how
fun.
much faith he has in you that he's like, yeah, come on in and improv. We're going to improv a scene. Boom. That's
Yeah,
you.
that's basically it. That was the audition. We did the audition over Zoom. It was me and the three guys from Spinal Tap, me and Michael McKean and Harry Shearer and Christopher Guest. And they gave me what the setup was, and we started ad-lib, and they all liked it, and I ended up getting the gig.
Well, I've seen everything they've done, so I'm thrilled for you, and I'm like, I'll be excited to be able to see that movie when it comes out.
And I'll tell you one final thing is
Okay.
April's a big month. April's a big month. I got the movie. I've got the thousandth performance. I also wrote my very first novel. I wrote a crime novel. We're in
What's
a
it called?
pandemic. It's called Outraged. And what it's about is my detective is a San Francisco investigative reporter, TV reporter, and his sister is LAPD, I'm sorry, it's SFPD homicide, and somebody is killing police officers who have shot unarmed black people and not been punished for it. And so they've got to unravel, the plot is they have to unravel who's doing this. Who is committing these murders. It comes out on April 23rd, and we're going to have a big book launch at Book Passage in Corte Madera on Sunday the 28th. So far the advance on it has been good. The reviews and the blurbs thus far have been very, very good. So it's going to be a series. The second I've already written the second book. They liked the first one. They wanted to publish one on the
Wow.
second one. So second one comes out next April. And what that one it's called Shadows of Justice, the second one. And what that one is about is the disparity in media coverage between when a white woman goes missing and when a black woman goes missing. So that's what I deal with there. That's why I want these books to be about something. Of course, there's a
Sure.
thriller element and there's the detective and mystery element, but I also want it to be about something. I want them all to be about something.
Excellent, excellent. Ryan Copeland, you've made my day because you've given
Oh.
us scoop after scoop after scoop of things that everyone wants to see and hear. So, congratulations on being able to do your 1,000th performance, and I look forward to the when you drop the book, and I look forward to the Spinal Tap movie. So, thank you for being on the show
Oh, thank you.
today.
Thank you. I hope you'll come out to the marsh and check us out.
Oh, you bet I will. Okay.
All
People
right. Thanks
of
for
Earth.
having me.
Thank you. People of Earth, this is your opportunity. Brian Copeland at the Marsh. It's going to be fantastic. And a book signing. I wasn't even expecting that. That was like a little extra. And then Spinal Tap. Come on now. Come on now.
All that you touch, and all that you see, and all that you taste, all you feel, and all that you love.